Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture. So today's speaker is Professor Urs Gesser. My name is Valentina Goglio. The speaker of today is Professor Dr. Urs Gesser, who is Professor of Public Policy, Governance and Innovative Technology at the Technical University of Munich, where he serves as Dean of the School of Social Sciences and Technology. Before joining the Technical University of Munich, he was Executive Director of the Bergmann-Klein Center for Internet Society at Harvard University and Professor of Practice at Harvard Law School. His research focuses on societal and regulatory implications of new technologies, such as cloud computing, artificial intelligence, and quantum technology. He's the author of several books. The most recent ones are The Connected Parent, An Expert Guide to Parenting in the Digital World, then Remembering and Forgetting in the Digital Age, dealing with the issues of data protection and privacy from a holistic and interdisciplinary approach, and Big Data, Health Law and Bioethics, exploring the ethical concerns associated to the use of big data in the healthcare sphere. Welcome, Professor Gesser. I would open this speech with one simple question. So, do we still need the social sciences in the digital era?
Thank you first and foremost, Valentina, for the very kind introduction and for co-hosting this session. Valentina is actually an expert on the things I'm going to talk about, so hopefully we can be in conversation. Special thanks also to Juan Carlos de Martin for inviting me here. Hi, everyone. It's wonderful to be with you today and really reflect on this question, social sciences. What's the role of social sciences in an age that seems to be so focused on technology and science? And in response to your question, I would say, yes, we need the social sciences more than ever before. And exactly because we focus so much on technology development, technological advancements, breakthroughs in science, we also need to bring the best social science research to the table. Yes, we need technology to tackle some of the world's biggest challenges, whether it's climate change, whether it's social injustice, whether it's the fight against the pandemic or the next public health crisis. We need the best technologies. But I think what we've also learned, and I hope, Valentina, you agree, is that technology alone will not do the trick. So first of all, technologies, they don't just fall from sky and are given to us. No, the kinds of technologies that are developed in labs that are funded by venture capitalists and so forth are very much a product also of the societal context, of the legal context, of the economic context in which they are developed, right? So think about Silicon Valley or Shenzhen or the Politecnico here in Torino or my university in Munich. These are environments that shape, of course, also the types of technologies that are developed. And one role of social sciences is really to help understand how these contextual factors, whether it's the money, whether it's the people and talent, or whether it's the policies and laws, how they actually influence and foster the development of technology, the kinds of advancements that are possible, the types of scientific progress that's emerging. And we can see, of course, it's very cultural specific when I just mentioned Shenzhen as an example vis-a-vis Silicon Valley. And the second role, I think, where we see a boost for social sciences is not only on the development side and understand these ecosystems for innovation better, it's also when it comes to adoption of technology. We now have amazing technologies in the making, right? We'll talk a little bit about artificial intelligence, and you may have attended other lectures focusing on that. We are now at the beginning of the second quantum revolution, where we see quantum technologies coming out of the labs. But if people like you and me don't understand how these technologies work, if we don't, as a society, develop the safeguards around these technologies, it's very unlikely that we will trust them. It's very unlikely that we will really unlock as societies the full potential of technology to address, again, some of these pressing problems. And how do we create trust in technology? What's the idea of trustworthy AI? What does it mean? What safeguards do we need to have in place? I think these are exactly the questions where social science research can help us at least to move in the right direction and organize the interplay between technology, society, to the benefit of humanity. So it's a longer answer probably than you expected, but I would definitely argue, yes, more important than ever. And maybe this is a segue into the presentation, if that's okay for you, Valentina. What I would like to do over the next half an hour or so is to share a few reflections with you all. And I'm coming to you not so much as an expert on science and technology studies or a scholar of the history of science. I'm coming to you as a humble practitioner. You've heard that I have been working in the United States for about 20 years, looking at the interplay between one specific type of technology, digital technology, largely driven and enabled by internet technology, and societal developments. And now I've changed some sort of the side in terms of the Atlantic side, moving to Europe. And not only that, but moving from a very strong humanities and social science environment, Harvard University, to a technical university, where, of course, the question is how do these questions of social science play out in a technical environment where the disciplines that are the strongest are, of course, engineering, design, computer science, and the like. And what does it mean to build something like responsible technology in such an environment where social science isn't some sort of already baked into the fabric? And so these experiences shape what I'm going to talk about today. So I'm coming to you really as someone from practice in some sense, while I also hope to reflect a little bit on the theory. Now, that being said, of course, to start the conversation about social sciences without at least looking back in history just for a minute or two would not be thoughtful. And when I was preparing for the conversation today, I just again read up on the history of social sciences and refreshed my memory. And maybe three points that are worth highlighting, I think, as we set the stage. The first point is that the social sciences as an academic discipline is a fairly recent invention, if you will. So it's only at the beginning of the 20th century that social sciences became some sort of an accepted, established, respected disciplines within academia. Of course, social thought, so thinking about society and humanity, dates back all the way to the Greek philosophers, and there's been a long tradition, for sure, but as a discipline, it only emerged at the outset of the 20th century. The second point that I think may be helpful to keep in mind as we are now moving to the digital context and the AI context in just a minute is that the agenda, what some sort of social science is about, what question social scientists address, was very much shaped in the 19th century and by two twin revolutions. One was the Democratic Revolution, so essentially coming out of the French Revolution, that meant a complete reordering of society and power structures on the one hand side. And second, the Industrial Revolution, which of course was also very significantly shaped by back then new technologies, right? And so it's this twin revolution that basically made people, made scholars, made everyone think about societal ordering, about the structure of living together, about institutions, about the regulation of human behavior, about future of work back then, right? The topic you're teaching currently. And so it's really interesting that these two seismic shifts in society were some sort of right there and informing the agenda of this newly born discipline, social sciences. And maybe the third point also worth reflecting that some sort of makes me think, and maybe we can save that for the discussion part. Today we differentiate about different social sciences, right? So you've seen in the title, it says not social science, it says social sciences, plural. And so we have things like, you know, sociology, of course, we have psychology, anthropology, economics, political science, and then depending on culture and context, a few other sub-disciplines that together form the social sciences. But interestingly enough, in the 19th, early 20th century, it wasn't entirely clear that we would see this differentiation within the social sciences. But rather, there was actually a strong movement to say it should be a unifying concept. It should be studying humanity as a whole. So it should be the social science and not sciences. And the differentiation within these different branches of social science were largely driven by the emergence of research universities, particularly in Germany, and actually internal competition among scholars. And so today we have all these departments at universities, right? And economics and political science were like the first really significant communities using different methodologies and essentially pushing towards specialization of something that was conceived to be more holistic. Now, fast forward, and this may be the discussion part, I know Valentina is teaching computer scientists and social scientists students to bring together these two different worlds of social science and computer science. Now, the question really is, right, are we teaching, that's difficult enough to build this bridge across disciplines, but now do we really have to teach like six disciplines within the social sciences? Is that really the way to go? Or should we reconsider and ask what are the basic questions within social science? So anyway, I just mentioned these three some sort of characteristics at the moment where social sciences as a discipline emerged in the late 19th, early 20th century, because I do feel there are some questions from back then that may resonate with today as well. So if we now ask ourselves, well, what may this moment in history teach us for today? I think two things can stand out. One, what social sciences deal with, the problems, the issues, the challenges and opportunities social science research and teaching cares about is very much shaped by external events on the one hand side, right? So think about, again, democratic French Revolution and this industrialization to simplify it, right? These are kind of big shocks and shockwaves. And so social science deals with these external shockwaves. And secondly, as I also mentioned, there are internal reasons. So the specialization, for instance, has come because scientists are using different methods to attack one question that's relevant to society. And I would argue that these two dynamics, so the external and the internal, may also be a helpful frame as we consider, well, in this digital age, as we are now at the dawn of the AI age, what may be interesting today and how may it shape what social science will be about or social sciences will be about in the years to come. And so with that framework in mind, I would like to propose three relevant seismic structural shifts. I wouldn't say these shifts are as big as the Industrial Revolution or as the Democratic Revolution, but I still think they're significant enough that it will have implications for social sciences. The first such structural shift is the digital transformation. And more specifically, I would argue, it's essentially what digital does to information. When I started studying technology and society issues, it was just about the time when I sent the first email. Now you can guess how old I am, right? But so it was like in the mid-90s when I started to use email and later on search engines. And this was the moment where something exciting seemed to happen. Before that moment, essentially the production of information or the dissemination, distribution of information, or how to access information or use information, was essentially in the hand of a few professionals. So journalists produced information, right? And TV stations were in the business of broadcasting that entertainment or content and information, news, for instance, and so forth. So what the internet some sort of introduced was suddenly a shift. Who's an information producer, right? And the answer was, well, all of us. And I think that's still true today. We produce tons of information by taking pictures, by posting things on Twitter or Instagram, by, you know, doing a snap or whatever your favorite social media app is. And that has been a structural shift in who produces information, under whose control, how is information distributed, and has some sort of changed a lot of things in society. We essentially moved from a world where the focus was on space as a place to a world of spaces of flows, because this information was not only some sort of produced, no, actually it was set free, and the internet obviously being the basic infrastructure and network through which information has been flowing ever since. The second seismic shift, again, maybe not of the magnitude of the Industrial Revolution, the jury is still out, some argue it's as big as the Industrial Revolution, is artificial intelligence and automation. And the story there, what I think is interesting, is it's not so much about the information, although, of course, AI relies on data, on massive amounts of data, on big data. But what's really interesting about AI is that it takes data to make it actionable, to make it relevant by making decisions. So what we see in AI is now a gradual shift for who makes decisions from the human being towards the machine. So think about self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles. We talked about it this morning as an example, where it's not the human driver, but a smart system that was programmed by people educated here at the Politecnico that starts to make decisions based on pattern recognition, on many, many different sensor inputs and the like. And that quality, so who makes decisions, for instance, if you apply to college or if you apply for a bank loan, and suddenly it's no longer the human beings, the program officers or the loan officer, but an AI, a combination of data from the past and the algorithms that use this data to make predictions about how likely it is that you will be a fantastic student or that you will pay back a loan. That's some sort of what's happening as a shift that will and leads, as we already see, to new questions for social science, for instance, bias, fairness, accountability, transparency. It's a long list we could talk about. Now, the third seismic shift, I would argue, that is exciting but also slightly scary when it comes to this techno age and social sciences is that everything we do in the digitally networked space leaves traces behind it. Now, many of us, of course, have read about or experienced the challenges to our privacy that comes with digital technology. We all read about surveillance capitalism, that, you know, we are the product, that we are no longer in control of our data, but big tech companies are and know much more about us than even our best friends or our family. And I think that's all true and is a problem that needs to be addressed, and we have a lot of efforts on the way, including legislation, particularly in Europe, but also in the US. There's a whole lot of dynamic to course correct. But from a social science perspective, it's also hugely exciting. Because imagine the time when social science became a discipline. It was much harder to observe people's behavior. You had to watch very closely as a researcher and scientist who's talking to whom, and so you had some sort of a looking glass at best to highlight interactions or to track people's movements. Today, just again, think about the cell phone, the smartphone. It's very easy to track all of us, where we are going, where we've been, with whom we've been in proximity. And so, in a way, the same traces of data that are scary on the one hand side when being misused by companies are also enabling us to describe, understand, and analyze human interactions and movements and so forth in much more detail and with greater precisions. And I would argue that's perhaps the third biggest driver of evolution within social science that we will see over the next 10, 15 years, that we have new microscopes for analyzing human behavior. And I will return to that if we have time towards the end. All right. So before we take a quick break, let me just share three examples from my own work with these structural shifts in mind, where it hopefully illustrates how classic questions of social science research can now be revisited and challenged, and maybe the answers to these old questions may look slightly different than we thought, where, you know, these digital shifts and technologies challenge our way of conceptualizing core social science concepts of the past. The first example is about identity, or better, identities. Now, identity, of course, has been a concept in social science, in sociology, in psychology for a very long time. And people have, scholars have studied it and so forth. Now, roughly, there is a division between two types of identities for each person, which is the personal identity, so it's essentially who I think I am, and the social identity, which is what you all think who I am. And for a long time, these two things have been interacting, but have been relatively stable. So to give an example, I grew up in a small town called Gerlafingen in Switzerland. It's about 4,500 people. I went to school there, and it's small enough that, you know, you cannot go to any place without knowing someone. Some of you may know this feeling, right? You just can't escape this small town. And my social identity was sticky. I couldn't. If I would wear different clothes, people would realize. Or if I had a new haircut, they would realize and say, yeah, you have been to the hairdresser, or why are you so strangely dressed today? So these are, of course, moments of social identity creation, right? Where someone starts this feedback loop and attribute things to you and attach it as labels to your person. And this was very hard to change. Only when I left Gerlafingen, this small town, and went to St. Gallen to study at St. Gallen University, you know, 200 kilometers away, I had an opportunity to reset my social identity, because I met new people who didn't know me since I was like age 2. And that felt really good. Now, fast forward in internet times, today's times, young people, which we studied with Sandro Cortesi being the team leader, we've talked to young people, age 12 to 18 in particular, to understand how in this digitally connected world identity formation may look like. And you have just a few, some sort of impressions of the types of identities that emerge today. So if a kid is gaming, for instance, and has an identity, an avatar, even in a gaming environment, that invites a form of interaction and a form of social identity that's very different than the same kid is interacting with a teacher using whatever, Google Docs or whatever, right? So what we've seen over and over again is that social identity has become a much more fluid concept in due to the digital transformation and the spaces it has opened up for interaction. Now, I briefly mentioned surveillance, which is now a trend contrary to this idea that we can experiment with our identities online. For instance, my Instagram self looks very different than my professional, you know, website self, and that's very different from how I talk to my friends over WhatsApp. Yet, of course, behind all these different identities, the social identities, there is someone or some force that also has insights into all these different me's, and these are the platforms. And so there is kind of a tension again. While we may experience new freedom to experiment our social identities or with our identities, there may still be a new form of stickiness. Now, the point being, identity has been a concept at the core of social science research for a long time. You see now how digital conditions may actually challenge some of these very concepts and how identity emerge. I used one example, right? The story from the village versus being in cyberspace or in the internet. And this may have implications for well-being. It may have implications for young people's freedom to experiment and find out about different gender identities, for instance, to find communities where they have a sense of belonging to. But it also comes with risks, like risks to be bullied, for instance, or safety risks. And however we land on these questions, what I want to share here is to say these are all interesting, hard questions for social science research, both empirically, but also normatively. So when we learn more about these opportunity and challenges and dynamics, well, in what direction do we want to move as a society? What are the implications for parenting? What laws should be in place to protect, for instance, children, but also to safeguard the freedom to explore different identities? So I'm using it just to give you a sense how exciting and interesting these questions are that are very old, but now have a new flavor, new twists, and sometimes unexpected outcomes due to these shifts that I was talking about. Let me maybe just use a second example for the sake of time and save the third one if we have time during discussions. So identity is one illustration. A second classic from social science is institutions. So institutions is one way to regulate human behavior, right? So before the advent of digital technology, we had a bunch of those. They're still around. So laws, right? I'm a lawyer by training. Law is regulating behavior. So it's essentially saying, the law says, you know, if you drive too fast and the speed limit is 50 kilometers per hour, you get a fine. And the assumption is by stating that and by the risk that you are caught by the traffic cop, you will adjust your behavior and stick to roughly the speed limit. We know it doesn't work always, right? But it works fairly well overall. So we have lots of laws that are some sort of based on this idea to threaten sanctions if you don't behave according to the norms. Law, just as a footnote, is more complicated than that, but for the argument's sake, let's just stick with that example. But it's not only laws, it's also social norms that shape behavior. So when Valentina and I met today in person for the first time, we greeted each other. We were doing small talk before we went into substantive conversations. This is the way we are educated. These are the social norms that shape our behavior. Or take architecture. The way this space here, this aula, is built, it doesn't invite for conversation. It invites for a guy standing here or a gal and lecturing. And so you see that architecture too is shaping how we behave. A last example would be markets. Think about cigarettes. So one way to make cigarettes less attractive is to increase taxes on cigarettes to make them more expensive. So markets usually regulate behavior through price. High price shapes the demand. So these are some of the tools we've had in the toolbox for years to shape human behavior. But now something happened as we move to the digital age. What happened is that we have an even more powerful tool to regulate behavior. And that's what's called code or software. So think about it. What we can do on our smartphones is both enabled, but importantly, also restricted by the people who have created this ecosystem, let's say, for instance, the iPhone ecosystem, the people who make decisions about what apps go into the app stores and what not. It's a very controlled process. And of course, also the people who designed and programmed the app itself. We're constrained in our behavior with what we can do based on how these devices are programmed. And so you see a new force coming into the world of behavioral regulation, which is code. And so in the late 90s, there was an aha moment where social scientists started to realize, well, that's a revolution happening. As our lives move more and more online and digital using tools like this, we simultaneously have a real-time, real-world social experiment in how to regulate behavior by using software, by designing interfaces, by enabling but also constraining what we can do over our platforms. And the last thing I want to say on this topic is the consequences of this new powerful tool to regulate human behavior. I think we're only at the beginning to understand what that means. Take the example of law. So we are now at a moment in time where good old law, take contracts, right? Each of us, when we go outside and order a coffee, that's a contract. We exchange an offer that's then accepted. I order a coffee, that's the offer, and the acceptance is the person giving out the coffee, or it can also be the other way around if, you know, the coffee is advertised and I say, yes, for €1 I want the espresso, then that's the acceptance. But you get the point, right? We do contracts all the time. Now, there is a trend to replace these old forms of contracting by new technology, blockchain technology, smart contracts, which is essentially using code to replace what previously was a human word-based and sometimes written, often you have contracts in writing, therefore the picture on the left, right, by computer code. Now this sounds great, and you know, blockchain enthusiasts, probably we have some in the room, like the idea because smart contracts lower transaction costs, right? They are reducing uncertainty, because in order to be computable, you need to be sure, both parties need to be sure about all the details of the transaction, which can be a good thing. And smart contracts, because they're written in the blockchain, cannot be changed. They're fixed forever. There's no argument who said what, and I thought this, and the other person says, no, I thought that, like in the good old world of written contracts. No, it's perfectly defined. It's perfectly executed too. But the big social science research question is that a good thing or a bad thing? And under what circumstances? So much of my work right now, for instance, is looking at the qualities that are changing as we move from an old set of institutions like law or contract to a new world where code is law, where smart contracts are replacing what's called as wet contracts. For instance, and that's the last sentence on this topic, one of the beauties of good old law is that it leaves open the possibility of adjustment. So think about divorce or getting married. So getting married is a legal act, but the law already anticipates that people may change. That's not the hope, right? Of course, you hope to live happily together forever, but there may be circumstances where it's better to go separate ways. And the law has quite often already rules in mind the moment you enter a relationship, same with contracts, that circumstances may change such that it's better and in the people's interest to revisit the earlier decision. Now, what if we live in a code is law world? Does it mean if this reversibility or plasticity that the law offers gets lost? It's a second example that I want to offer of the types of questions I think we have ahead of us as we are moving so quickly into a world where machines are making decisions, where code is executing and regulating in ways that are unprecedented. And here again, you see social science revisiting old questions like institutions and who regulates behavior, how. But suddenly the story gets really different and really interesting and exciting. And therefore, again, I hope you slowly but surely get convinced that, yes, there is a role of social science to be played in the age of AI. So I break here, as I'm sure we have a few questions, and I have also more slides if needed, but we can stop here.
Thank you. So thanks a lot for what's said so far, and I think that your examples show quite well this two-way interaction between technology, whatever type of technology, in particular digital technologies, but also other types of technology, technology and society, no? This two-way interaction and how the two shape each other. I appreciate that you highlighted that the outcome is not always predetermined. No, there is room for unexpected or unintended consequences as well. So you talk a little bit about the contribution that the social sciences can give to the study of technology and the technological transformation. Also, I would like to ask you, what are the new opportunities that are provided to social sciences? You partly mentioned like I like this idea of retrieving old questions and maybe finding new answers. So I want to ask if you can add a little bit about this, the new opportunities. And then I have another question, but maybe I save it for later if you're not
sure.
Too late.
Sure. Well, if I may, it's also a really good segue to the last couple of slides I have, and I skip one. So the first, I see some sort of three exciting opportunities of social science in this new world of technology. The first is what I alluded to in the beginning, is essentially a new way to look at the world of human behavior. And I mentioned already this idea of building a new microscope of social science research. And to me, that's not only a methodological contribution enabled by technology, but also an analytical contribution, because we can better understand certain things, certain phenomena that we didn't understand before the same way, or we weren't able to measure in the same way and then make sense of what we measure. So one example that sticks with me, again, from my own time as a researcher and working at Harvard, was roughly 2008, 2007. The cutting-edge technology then was blogs. Does anyone remember what blogs are? So this looks like, I don't know, what's comparable today? It's like, it's not Twitter, it's Medium. Yeah, it's like, some of you may know Medium articles, something like that. And that was really a thing. So, and of course, social media was some sort of booming and growing back then. Facebook was a really big thing. What's Facebook, right? But anyway, back then it was really popular. And we were sitting around the conference table with, you know, professors and students and fellows. And the big question was, these new ways to produce information, I alluded to it already when I talked about the structural shifts, will they lead to more democracy? Will this be good for democracy? And guess what? We were mostly excited. We thought, yeah, this will be good. It will democratize everything. There were some skeptics in the room already saying, well, not so sure. And so there were really interesting discussions going on. And then two guys were kind of arguing different positions, Jochai Benkler and Ethan Zuckerman. And they disagreed. So they couldn't agree on the answer to this question. Is this leading to more echo chambers or better conversations and this marketplace of ideas and strengthening democracy? What the amazing thing was, the outcome of this meeting was, we should find out. And the question was, well, how do we find out? Well, we're social scientists. We can measure things by using the affordances of new technologies. We can build new microscopes. And so fast forward, what emerged from that conversation was a project later known as Media Cloud, which essentially started to download everything that was published across 1,000 media sources, which included traditional newspapers and online sources, but also a sample of blogs that were particularly popular, but also a sample of social media sites and streams, and basically allowed to track down, so it was almost like a tape that was recording whatever was published. And so when a researcher came and said, well, how did Trump get elected, right? And how was it that rumors about Hillary Clinton were spread? And who spread these rumors? Where did they come from? You could go basically back into this archive of recorded media from these different sources and start to track down how, let's say, misinformation traveled, or how a new idea that was introduced in the political discourse traveled. So I'm just using that as an illustration for the kinds of tools we are now able to build. And so today we have many more tools and techniques, largely also fueled by data science and by computer science, network analysis, content analysis. We have can deal with very large data sets, many more than we did back then with Media Cloud. And I think the innovation there is really that we have now what is called computational social science, which is a new set of tools to really look into human behavior, to study humans by looking at the data and the data traces that leave behind. And that, to me, seems one of the big contributions of social science in this new area that doesn't have an equivalent if you go back to the 19th century or early 20th when the whole thing started as a serious academic enterprise. If I may, maybe a second role, which is moving from the methodological innovation and the analytical to the normative. Many of you may follow the discussion about AI ethics and the question, okay, if we see a shift from decision-making and autonomy away from humans to machines, and I mentioned a few examples, what should be the safeguards we have in play? You know, where should be red lines, for instance, when it comes to questions of bias or discrimination? Or think about dual-use technology. So AIs, for instance, can be used to discover new drugs. But the same algorithms can be used also to discover new chemical weapons. So how do we think about these problems? And what are the instruments we have as a society to draw red lines, but also to bring ethics to the development of these technologies? And so one big contribution of social science is not only to measure and analyze and explain. I think social science has a lot to offer when it comes to incorporating values into the design of technology. And so there is a really strong push right now to move beyond the descriptive and really work also on social sciences that have normative stand, whether it's a social justice agenda, whether it's human rights-based thinking and the like, and bring these core concepts into the conversation about technology development and the advancements of science and the role of science and technology in society. And the last point is related to what I just described. Perhaps the biggest opportunity, and I refer back to Valentina's teaching of social scientists sitting in a classroom with computer science students, is how do we bridge the gap between what has become a divided world of science, with engineering and social sciences and hard sciences over here, and humanities and social sciences over here. How do we bring that back together? If it's true what I said at the very beginning, that the focus on technology alone will not be sufficient to address some of the world's largest problems and unlock the good potential of technology, so that we need more than tech development and tech expertise. And the key to all this is very hard, which is to introduce reflexive practices to bring social science methods and tools and the microscopes we were talking about, but also the mindset, the kind of questions we're after, into the labs where new breakthroughs are happening or where science research is happening. That's not easy, that's not a trivial task. Universities are structured in a way that we operate in silos, and we have to cut across these silos. The Technical University of Munich, for instance, is merging faculties together into new schools to break down silos between disciplines. The reason why, as you introduced me kindly, why I'm the dean of the TUM School of Social Sciences and Technology is because a technical university recognized we have to bring social sciences to the source of tech development and engineering and science. Because if social science becomes an afterthought, we continue to play catch-up the same way we do now, where we have wonderful technology, but we have also very problematic technologies and haven't had the chance as a society to talk about these questions of value and purpose and safeguards and ethical norms. And I think that's the biggest opportunity that we have today, because unlike the French Revolution, and probably unlike the dynamics of the Industrial Revolution, we have better knowledge, we have better tools today to work together across disciplines to shape and co-create our future. And that keeps me going and keeps me excited about building bridges from the social science side into technology, but of course also the other way around. Thank you.
Maybe we can open the floor to questions. Well, thanks a lot for your speech, and absolutely, I think this is very exciting and challenging at the same time. Well, if you will have some time, maybe we collect some of the questions, and then I wanted to ask you something about the difference, because you did research in the US and in Europe, so if you can just add something on the differences that arise on this.
Thank you. I actually originally come from a social sciences background, and then I moved towards engineering, so I understand the by interest in both. But what I found, we speak of a world full of science and information, but my personal feeling was that we do not make much use of that in the social sciences department. Not everywhere, but in quite some particular cases, which are oftentimes the most predominant ones, because it feels like they're quite often intense with ideology. So I feel like they're missing out the science part of the social science. I mean, we end up just quoting the professor who is teaching, and it's referring back to that, but there is no, I don't want to be so deterministic, but it feels like they are not putting science much into that. And I really love the example of your two colleagues. They were arguing, okay, let's figure it out, right? I don't feel that is the case anymore. I feel like one of those colleagues would end up bashing the other colleague on social media for not being modern enough, for not being progressive enough, because he didn't embrace Facebook for the good thing, or and so on and so forth. And the second thing is that it seems like it's the idea that we can now more easily reset the social identity due to the internet age, but it is my impression that it was easier before, because you moved into your new city college, right? And you started from scratch. You don't start from scratch in the internet age. People will look back at your tweets when you were 12, and why weren't you the good person back then, and so on and so forth. So perhaps the consideration could be made otherwise rather than today. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent comments. I have nothing to add. We can talk much more about both aspects, but I completely agree. Wonderful statements, yeah. Thank you. Well, I mean, just on the first point, if we have time, I totally agree, right? So social science also operating in a silo, and that we have a culture that's not necessarily helpful for the bridge building, and I think that's one of the challenges, right? And that's why I actually committed to no longer wear my hat as a researcher, where I do this exciting work every day, but become an academic administrator, right, as a dean, because I really believe exactly what you say. We have to change our culture at universities. We have to, and especially also within social science, we have to become less ideological and much more open-minded. So the biggest challenges of all that is not technology, it's our mindset. And if we don't start to change our mindset and upgrade our mindset at universities, where else? And so I share your analysis of the situation that, you know, also within social sciences, we have a lot to work to do and can also learn from engineering, computer science, and many other disciplines where we see more robust, at times more robust disagreements and more productive discourse. And so that's a big challenge. The second point you made about the stickiness of social identity in the social media age, I think you're totally right. And I only alluded to it that, you know, it also some sort of backfires what seemed to be a hope at some point. And it's also interesting that regulators, for instance, have discovered that problem too. So for instance, the Californian regulators created a right to an eraser, so it's a version of the right to be forgotten, especially addressed at younger users, right, of social media, because, you know, if you're 16 or 15, you may not reflect on whatever the post may mean when you apply to college later on. And so I think you're totally right, it can play out both ways. One is it's more experimental, playful, exploratory, but then there is also the opposite that, you know, since it leaves a trace, people might find it and hold you accountable for things that were happening in a very different context. So totally agree.
So thanks a lot for the questions. I don't know if there are other people who would like to ask something. Apparently not. So, well, I may ask you one question.
Yeah,
I take advantage of this position. So, yeah, actually, well, I was wondering whether you partly mentioned some examples from the US and also from Europe. So if you can just add a little bit in 2 minutes, maybe it's a bit challenging, but what are the different approaches both at the stage of production and of regulation of technology in these two areas?
I would say it's a really interesting moment in time, right? If you look at the geopolitics and regulation and technology and values, and to me there are like four different dynamics and traditions. One is the US tradition to look at technology and society and the role innovation plays. And I would say the stereotype we have that the US is oriented towards innovation and the policies are shaped to let innovation happen before regulating it, there is something to that. And that the policies actually that are in place are more enabling than constraining when it comes to innovation and innovative technology. So I think there is a tradition. I think in Europe we have a different approach for also historic cultural reasons. It's more dominated by the precautionary principle that we tend to regulate earlier when it comes to innovative technologies. We see it now with AI, where Europe has become a leader in technology regulation, but also if you look at big tech platforms, Europe is taking the lead. And it's motivated by this sense that these technologies, that we need safeguards, we need rules around them to manage risk, to avoid some of these bad outcomes that I alluded to. So in Europe, we are quicker and more confident to use law and regulation. Again, I'm simplifying, but compared to the US, there are also constitutional reasons and so forth. And then, of course, we have China, where the role of law and regulation is a different one. It's not an environment where law is seen as a basic safeguard for people, what we mean by the rule of law here, a very old Western concept that protects us from the state as citizen, and protects our freedom. But in China, you have to rule by law, where law is something that's another tool for the powerful, in other words, the Communist Party, to achieve its goals. And the same with technology, right? Technology is regulated in China quite heavily, but there is an agenda and there is a very clear destination whom this technology should serve. Think about the credit score system as an example. And then the fourth is perhaps the most interesting force at play, which is the world that hasn't decided yet, the countries that haven't decided yet which way to go. Many countries on the African continent, in Latin America, and in other parts of Asia. And there I see a real responsibility for Europe to lead the way, but not necessarily by forcing countries in very different states of development to copy and paste the general data protection regulation or the new AI Act, but actually adopt and contextualize some of the ideas of value-based, human rights-based, rule of law-based regulation in a technology age, but not for the regulation's sake, but actually to build a better, fairer, more equitable society. And so one of the reasons why I came back to Europe is to be part of this project, because I think it's a unique moment in time. And if I would have to place my bet from a values perspective, I think the European way has a lot to offer compared to the alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you also for this. For this last geopolitical glance. Okay, so I think the session is over, and thanks a lot to all of you who came and listened to this talk. And thanks a lot, Professor Gasser.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.